Welcome to Profiles. I'm Karen Hansen, Provost of Indiana University. Profiles is a weekly program that introduces members of our community, as well as visiting scholars, artists, and political figures, to the WFIU audience. We are delighted to have as our guest today Alexandra McCall Smith, one of the world's most productive and most popular authors. Alexandra, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed for the invitation, Karen.
Your career has been a varied one and hugely successful in all its dimensions. You're an expert in medical law and bioethics, and were for many years a professor in universities in the United Kingdom and Botswana and elsewhere, chair of the British Medical Journal Ethics Committee, former vice chairman of the Human Genetics Commission of the United Kingdom, and a former member of the International Bioethics Commission of UNESCO. You're the author or co-author of at least 12 academic texts on topics in law and medicine, and yet all the while you've also been writing fiction, scores of children's books, short stories, collections, and novels. How have you managed to keep both tracks so successfully going together, academic and public policy work on the one hand and creative writing on the other?
Well, for a long time, when I was doing all those various other things, I had to keep my writing very much in the background. And so writing was something that I did in my spare time. And I think that many authors actually have to do that. The vast majority of writers of fiction, for example, have to do something else. They have to have a job to keep the wolf from the door. And in their spare time, in such time as they manage to scrape together, they can write their books. And so I was in that position. And it was only when my books, I suppose, took off that I was able to make the choice. And that's the point at which I decided that I very much enjoyed the other career that I'd had, but that I'd like to try to be a full-time writer. And then, of course, once one starts being a full-time writer, you realize that you're actually prevented by all the things that go with the books perhaps being a bit more successful from spending all your time writing, because you spend a lot of time touring and doing things related to the books. So I think the goal of being a full-time writer is a fairly elusive one for everybody.
And yet you've been writing since you were a child. I understand you submitted your first manuscript at the age of 8.
Yes, well, children often write books. Lots of children say they're going to sit down and write a book, and usually they get to about page 2, and then they decide they've had enough. In my particular case, I think I probably didn't get much beyond page 2, but I was, I suppose, an ambitious 8-year-old, and I sent my manuscript off to a publisher. I don't know what it was about. All that I remember was the title, and the title was He's Gone. But where he went or why he went, I can't recall at all.
Do you recall who he was?
And I don't recall who he was or what made him go. But the nice thing was that I sent it off to a book publisher, and I had a letter back, which was very, very encouraging, because it would have been very easy for the publisher just to toss the thing straight into the waste paper basket. But the publisher wrote me a very nice letter back, and I suppose that that might have encouraged me. Had I had a rejection at the age of 8, I might never have done anything else of that nature. I don't know.
Well, it's an intriguing title. I can see why a publisher would be drawn in. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background, your childhood, and when and how you developed the interests you did?
Well, I spent my childhood in rather unusual circumstances. I spent my childhood in the middle of Africa, in what was then southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. So it was a slightly unusual upbringing, slightly unusual beginning in this life. But it did, of course, give me an interest in Africa and a feeling for that part of the world. And I suppose, had I not had that, I would not have ended up writing the books set in Botswana, the number one ladies' detective agency books. I was quite a keen reader. When I was a boy, I remember I read voraciously. I had a wonderful set of books called the Children's Encyclopedia, Arthur Mee's Children's Encyclopedia, which was the most extraordinarily constructed children's encyclopedia that drifted from subject to subject. So you'd have 4 pages on the history of the steam engine, and then immediately you'd go into Longfellow, for example. And so I read this from volume 1 to volume 20, which I suppose got me going. And certainly I remember learning a lot of poetry off by heart, which was quite a good start, I think, for a writer actually to be forced to commit poetry to memory.
Did your family encourage this reading and writing?
Yes, they did. My mother in particular was very keen on reading. She read a lot herself, and I think I was given every encouragement. I wasn't pushed unduly, but I was certainly given every encouragement. She spent a lot of time writing a novel herself, which grew larger and larger. It was all typed out, and nobody was ever allowed to read it. And eventually it filled a fairly substantial box, this manuscript. But she'd left very strict instructions that on her death she didn't want anybody to read it and would we destroy it, which my sisters obliged because that was a particular request. So heaven knows what the novel was about, except we did know that it was set in the Congo. But what actually happened there, I just don't know. But so she was interested in that.
That's a remarkable act of fidelity to the mother's wishes. You've written a lot of children's fiction, and I think you wrote children's fiction before you had children, didn't you?
Yes, I started writing children's books by accident. I didn't think that I would ever write them, but what actually happened was that a Scottish publisher, Chambers, who are known for their Chambers Dictionary, which they publish, decided that they wanted to spread their wings a bit and publish rather different sort of books as well. So they had a literary competition back in the late 1970s, and there were various categories of manuscripts that could be entered. One was fiction for adults, and another was fiction for children, and I entered manuscripts in both of those categories, hoping that I'd win the category for the general novel. But in fact, I didn't. But I did win. I was lucky enough to win the children's book category. And so that started me off. I then handed that manuscript over to an agent who very much encouraged me. And so I started writing children's books. And then once I had my first children's book published, obviously it was easier to get the second one published if you stayed in that particular genre. Publishers tend to think in genre terms. So I found myself under contract to write more and more children's books, which I did for a number of years and which I enjoyed. But all the time I think that I was also wanting to write something else. So I started writing short stories and then eventually novels. And now I write the occasional children's book, but usually rather more novels.
Well, these genre distinctions are interesting because you're so well known now for the detective fiction and also, of course, for the children's books. Is this an unusual combination? How do you balance the two?
Well, I think there are some writers who write across genres and perhaps who also feel inclined to defy the strict categorization of books into genres, which I think sometimes can be an unhelpful categorization in that there are some books which obviously transcend genre or span different genres. So I was rather hostile to the idea of just writing in one particular area. And I was able eventually to escape the genre trap when I started having novels published. But then, of course, I faced being put into another category in that my first book about Mara Mutswe in Botswana had the word detective in it. And although the book is about a woman who runs a little detective agency, it's actually really more about her and her life, the society, its customs, the people whom she meets, and so on. But people said, oh, these are detective books, or mystery books, as they're known in the United States. So I'd fallen into another genre trap. And sometimes I go into a bookstore and I see some of my novels which have absolutely nothing to do with crime or mystery or any of that being put in that particular category. So it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. You've, in fact, described the detective agency as a literary device rather than something that defines the work in terms of genre. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Well, I think that detective fiction is actually really quite a useful form for being able to say a lot about a society or a place. If you look at a lot of these detective novels, they have a very, very strong sense of place. Indeed, the sense of place is a very important aspect of them. And indeed, some books in that category stand or fall according to the degree to which they achieve a strong sense of place. So it can do that sort of thing. The genre can do that sort of thing. They're also very good ways of dealing with the human psychology in that you can explore human motivation and you can explore the past of various characters. You can bring in a very richly textured psychological background for the characters. So there are those possibilities with detective fiction. In the case of the Number One Ladies Detective Agency, what I thought was that I would be able to bring in all sorts of characters into the agency to consult Mara Matsui, who would be bringing in all their backstory, their background, all their hopes, fears, emotions, and so on. And that would enable me to paint a picture of Botswana. Whereas if you try to do that within the confines of the conventional novel, it becomes quite difficult, because it's rather difficult to have a cast of hundreds in a conventional novel, and you tend to focus just on one or two issues and see them through the novel. So I found it a very useful device, because anybody can come into Mara Matsui's door and we can get a glimpse into all sorts of lives.
Well, the Number One Ladies Detective Agency series has sold over 20 million copies in English editions alone and has been translated into over 40 languages. The books are bestsellers around the world. They've been adapted now for radio and television and film. They're widely loved and admired. But are there differences that you note in the reception or understanding of them among readers in, say, Botswana and the U.S. and Great Britain?
That's a very interesting issue, because I think when a series of books achieves, I suppose, that sort of wide coverage, inevitably you would think that there would be different responses according to the cultural background of the readers, in that obviously there are some countries where a particular sort of book is liked and the same book may not be liked in other countries. And it would be very odd if the tastes of the universal global reading public were just all the same. Having said that, one of the things which has interested me is the extent to which those particular books seem to have struck a chord in all sorts of societies, in radically different societies. So, for example, the books are read very keenly in Scandinavia, in Sweden, for example, Finland, Norway, Denmark. And at the same time, they're read in Indonesia and India and China. So that raises rather interesting issues as to different responses. I, to an extent, detect some differences in that I think there are some aspects of the books which particularly appeal in particular countries. But generally speaking, what seems to transcend all these boundaries is the fact that Mara Matsui, the central character, is a very kind and forgiving character. And I think that that really means that she speaks a universal language. So she goes down well for that reason in all these different countries. There are people who say that the books present a rather too optimistic vision of Africa, of a particular African society, that they're too sunny, that they don't deal with the very acute problems which have to be faced in so many sub-Saharan African countries. So people do say that. And yet, interestingly enough, that approach hasn't really been taken in various African countries itself, where I found that in Botswana, for example, although obviously some people won't like them, you can never please everybody, but lots of other people feel, well, this is a very positive portrayal of the country, and they rather like that. They're used to outside writers looking at sub-Saharan Africa and writing very, very negative stuff. So I think that that raises interesting aspects. In the United States, I think they tend to be taken by the emotion in the books, and I think in the United States people are quite happy to confront quite moving emotions, and we get that in some of the situations that Mara Matsui concerns herself with.
Of course, the series has dealt with serious and difficult issues of domestic violence and social relations in traditional African society and women's roles. And yet there is, as you know, a kind of an optimistic and a humorous quality. How do you maintain that balance in writing?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because that really is the major difficulty, the major task. One mustn't fall over the boundary into sentimentalism. I think that is a real problem for writers who are going to deal with emotionally engaging subjects. What I've tried to do is to bring in some of the issues that you refer to there, some of the problems that you'll encounter in any society, but which I think, one encounters in fairly vivid form in many African societies, problems of abuse, for example, domestic abuse, illness, AIDS is one of the major issues. I bring those in, but I don't really want to put them center stage. I think that you can mention them, and indeed a subtle mentioning of a problem is often more effective than a very blatant, direct mentioning of it. So I do refer to AIDS, which of course is really a terribly serious problem in Botswana, as in so many other countries in the region. Botswana has a major difficulty with HIV/AIDS, where the rate of an infection is about 30% in adults of a particular age group, something, you know, the 19 to 45, that sort of age group. You would expect to find one in three people infected, which is really very, very serious. So obviously I can't ignore it, but what I try to do is to say, well, there are these difficulties, but at the same time people are leading ordinary lives, continuing with their lives in the face of these difficulties, against a background of these difficulties, because people don't just want to shut up shop and say, that's it, there was a terrible epidemic and we can't go on. They obviously have to go on, and they do go on. They go on with great generosity of spirit and courage. So that's the way I handle it. Try to keep the overall tone optimistic and positive, because that's the feeling that you get. If you visit an African country or live in an African country, you realize that people actually don't regard the world as being a totally bleak place, that they've got a great deal to offer in terms of, I suppose, a positive approach to life. So I try to achieve that balance.
Well, I think that's certainly something your readers admire in the work. And they're also hearing in part something about your own personality, I think, and voice coming out there. Our listeners are interested in learning more about you in a variety of ways, and one of the ways involves hearing something more about the music you treasure and enjoy. You've brought three selections here today, and I'm wondering if you can introduce the first one.
Well, the first one is a very, very favorite piece of mine. I love Mozart, and I think this particular trio from Così fan tutti, Soave sia il vento, is particularly moving. I think that particular opera, Così fan tutti, has a most ridiculous plot. Operas often are utterly ridiculous and impossible, and it's a very silly plot that Mozart uses there, and yet he writes the most divine music for it. And this particular trio is, I think, sublimely beautiful. I think it's the most beautiful piece of music ever composed by anyone. And I listen to it time and time again. I often listen to it when I'm writing, particularly when I'm writing my Isabel Dalhousie books. I'll put this particular piece of music on. And its message is a wonderful message. It's the message that we would like, I suppose, to give to anybody who was going off on a journey or doing something like graduating from a university or starting a new job. May the winds that follow you be gentle ones. May you have a safe passage through life is what it's really saying. And it's, I think, spine-tinglingly beautiful.
You mentioned the Isabel Dalhousie novels and the fact that you listen to that music and writing them. Let's talk a little bit about the Sunday Philosophy Club series. Is there any reason Isabel Dalhousie is half American?
No particular reason, other than that I have spent quite a bit of time, I suppose, on and off in the United States. I was for two shortish periods a visiting professor in Dallas, and I enjoyed that. I come to the United States two or three times a year and obviously have many American friends. I'm also aware of the fact that it was my American readers who really first discovered my books. Usually it's the other way around, that your books take off in your own country and then they take off, if they're going to take off, in another country. But this happened the other way around for me, in that my books had been published in the UK, and although I had some generous, kind reviews, nothing really particularly exciting was happening, and then the American readers got going on them. So I'm aware of the fact that I have a large American readership, and I very much like my American readership. And I thought that I would give Isabel a bit of that background, in that her mother at one stage lived in Dallas, and I also have her family, that side of her family, coming from Mobile, Alabama, because I went to Mobile, Alabama on a number of occasions and really liked it. And I thought the people of Mobile, Alabama were extremely agreeable people. So that's why she's half American. But she doesn't actually come to America, because I think writing about the United States, if you're a British writer, is quite difficult, and vice versa. British writers often get the United States wrong. It doesn't sound right if they write about the United States, if they put their characters in the US. And it doesn't sound right if American writers put their characters in Britain. So I'm aware of that.
Well, Isabel engages in a lot of interior rumination on the permissible, and I think you get just right what someone who's a professional philosopher would do, who's the editor of the Review of Applied Ethics. Is there a way in which your background in the law and in bioethics is playing a role there? In many ways, one hears the trained voice there, but in other ways, I would think that the subtlety of her ruminations is a little bit different than the clear-cut nature of the law. Am I wrong about that?
Well, no, I think you're right in that I think that comes from my direct personal interest in ethical issues, and in particularly in applied ethics. I used to obviously be quite involved in that when I was doing my various bits of public work on these various committees and commissions. And so I took an interest in that, and I also taught that sort of thing at university, in that I was involved in courses which touched on those issues. So that's where that comes from. But I also felt that it's the sort of thing that people actually rather enjoy reading about. I think people are intrigued by moral problems in their lives, how to treat their friends, how generous they should be, whether they can think uncharitable thoughts and get away with it, that sort of thing.
Well, in both of the detective series, both the Botswana and the Edinburgh series, that forgiveness seems to be a major theme. That's a very interesting moral notion, and in some ways rather difficult for the law to capture. Do you want to say something about its importance for you?
Well, I think forgiveness is terribly important. I think it's one of our great moral challenges in our day-to-day life. I think that we have to forgive people if we think that they've wronged us. We have to forgive them. And yet at the same time, it's something that most of us, myself included, I'm as bad as anybody else on this, finds it quite difficult to forgive. So I think it is a moral problem. And I think that if you look at the role of forgiveness, you'll see that it's absolutely crucial in getting ourselves out of any difficulty, whether one's talking about international relations, relations between states, whether one's talking about personal relations with friends and family and so on, where there's been something which has gone wrong. And forgiveness is the key to moving forward from all of this. And I think the problem is that there are times in our lives as communities and as an international community in particular, where we become very stuck in certain attitudes with certain attitudes, and we could really do with sitting down face to face and forgiving one another the past. I very much approve of politicians who stand up and make an apology for something which has been difficult. I think that actually is a very good thing to do. It was very interesting that Tony Blair was the first British Prime Minister, I think, who actually apologized to Ireland for unfortunate things in the relationship between the two countries in the 19th century. And Blair said sorry, which is great. It had to be said, and it took an awful long time for it to be said. And I think also that President Clinton in this country made a number of apologies. And in Australia recently, there was a very significant apology which was made by the comparatively recently elected Prime Minister, Mr. Rudd, who said that I want to apologise for the way that we treated Aboriginal people in this country in the following ways. And that was something which just enables healing to start. So I think this is absolutely crucial.
Is it tied, in your view, with taking responsibility and there being accountability? Because those are also topics.
Well, this is the issue. You see, I think that there is some relationship with that, clearly. But I think the problem is that if we stress accountability too much, then we can become quite punitive. And I think that we have become quite a punitive, retributive society, or many societies become quite punitive and retributive. And we want to punish people, and we want to find somebody that we can point the finger at. And I don't think that's always helpful. We have to have a certain element of that. You can't just have people walking away from the mess. But I don't think you need to dwell on the responsibility too much. And I think really the forgiveness is the issue.
Are there other virtues or moral notions that are of particular interest to you that you want to make sure Isabel or other of your characters confront in these novels?
Well, Isabel comes up with all sorts of things. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I like writing those novels, because she can face all sorts of issues. Recently, I was invited to give a number of talks in Utah, and I had a very agreeable host there. And we started a conversation about mountaineering, because he was interested in the history of mountaineering. And we started talking about mountaineering ethics. And that's fascinating. So that's going to be reflected in the Isabel books. What do you do if you're climbing Everest and you see somebody in difficulty? I would have thought that traditionally, if you were a mountaineer, you stopped and helped. But that seems to be changing. Apparently, people just walk past you because they want to get to the top, and it's been commercialized. So there are companies who want to get, they're paying climbers to the top. And so be very, very careful if you run out of oxygen.
A good warning. The interior contemplation of these moral issues that's so intriguing in some of these novels, where one of the things that's interesting is the characters noticing that there is a moral issue at stake, and it's not altogether obvious from the situation. It depends on their character that they notice it, is particularly attractive about these characters. You have sometimes suggested that the germ of thought for the hugely popular character of Precious came from seeing a woman of traditional build, as you put it, chasing a chicken around a yard. How does that germ grow into something that is so interesting because of the interior life and personality?
Well, I think that frequently if you look at a book, you'll see that there's this tiny germ of the idea, possibly way back. I remember looking at Roald Dahl's book about his life, and he made a note in his notebook, what about a story about a boy who visits a chocolate factory, from which, of course, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was born. And so a tiny idea can lead to the development of a very complex story. In that particular case, I saw this woman, and she was such a striking character, and she was so cheerful and pleasant as she went about this business of catching this chicken, that I just thought, wouldn't it be interesting to write about somebody like that in this country, in Botswana? And I started thinking about her life. And that's the way it works for me. I will meet somebody, and they may say something which triggers a train of thought. But I'll often wonder about somebody's life, about what their experiences have been, and so on. And that may just end up being a novel.
Well, you've mentioned that you're also sometimes moved in your writing by listening to music. Could we hear a little bit more about the second piece you've brought us?
Well, this is a piece of African music by Ayu Bogada, an East African musician, and it's called Kothbiro. And I gather that it's about the herding of cattle. And it's a lovely piece of music. I love African traditional music, and I think that this is so soulful and so moving that I listened to him quite a lot as well.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Welcome back to Profiles. I'm Karen Hansen, Provost of Indiana University, and it's our pleasure today to have with us Alexander McCall Smith. Alexander, you've written not only a number of series that have been hugely successful, the number one Ladies Detective Agency series and the Sunday Philosophy Club series and the 2.5 Pillars of Wisdom, but also serial novels. Can you say a little bit about the attractions and constraints of each form?
Well, serial novels I enjoy in particular. They're novels that are published as you write them, so to speak. Each chapter appears in a newspaper, and then you move on to the next one. I started writing those after I had a conversation with Armistead Maupin in California, who, of course, did Tales of the City, which was published in the San Francisco Chronicle. That gave me the idea, that conversation gave me the idea that I might do something similar myself. And I started one set in Scotland called 44 Scotland Street, set in Edinburgh. And I had no idea where the novel would go when I started it. I had no idea who the characters would be, what it was about, or anything, really. The only thing I knew was its title. We had a title, at least. And the series has run for the last 5 years in the Scotsman newspaper. I gave it a rest last year, but I'm starting it again with a sixth volume. So I enjoy that form of writing very much indeed, because you really are embarking upon an adventure when you start such a book, and you don't really know where it's going to go. And, of course, the readers can respond to you and can give you ideas about what should happen in the novel. So it's fairly interactive, in a sense. And that's different from series of novels where you've got a self-standing novel using the same characters and the same milieu, but obviously not quite as serially developed as the serial novel.
You've, in fact, encouraged readers to participate in the development of the plot. How does that really work?
Well, in the case of the recent serial novel that I did in the Daily Telegraph in London, that was published online day by day, a chapter each day. And so readers could just put their comments on the Telegraph webpage. So that was a fairly immediate form of feedback, really. Within a few hours of writing the chapter, I could see what people thought about it and what they thought about the direction in which the book could move. As far as the Scotsman novel was concerned, that tended to be by emails, and readers would write in and say, we're fed up with this character, could something happen to this character, something of that sort. And sometimes people would write in and ask you to do nasty things to characters. We had one character in Scotland Street who was a very extreme narcissist, and he was becoming progressively more unpopular, and one of the readers wrote in and said, please could something extremely unpleasant happen to Bruce, preferably involving a steamroller. So you get that sort of request, which I didn't heed that particular request.
Well, Well, it's a demanding form in so many ways because you can't revise either. Is that ever an issue for you?
It is a problem because you've committed yourself, you've published the chapters, and so sometimes you'll find that you introduce a character who really isn't going to go anywhere. So what you do is, what I do in those circumstances is that the character just disappears or no further mention is made of that character. And readers don't mind that because I think that's what life is like. Life isn't as it's envisaged in the conventional novel where you get resolution and where everything fits. Nothing fits terribly well in life. Life is, you know, we feel our way through life. And also we go up all sorts of odd blind alleys and such things. So life is messy, and serial novels tend to be a bit messy as well.
Well, you're working on so many of these things simultaneously. How do you keep that balance and keep the voice clear in each of the projects?
Well, I'm usually writing two books at a time, and so it is necessary to have some sort of ability to compartmentalize. So my life is compartmentalized. When I sit down, I try to remember which book I'm writing and where I am, which world I'm talking about. And then a different voice, the necessary voice for that particular book, comes out. I've definitely got different voices. I've got a voice for the number one ladies detective agency series, a voice for Isabel, voice for Scotland Street, Corduroy Mansions, and the German professor books. So it tends to be all right. Occasionally, I will find that I slip from one voice into another, and that happened once with one of the Mara Motsui manuscripts. I sent it off to Edward Kastenmeier, my editor in New York, and he said, I think on page whatever it was, Mara Motsui is sounding like Isabel Dalhousie. What do you think? And I read it, and of course, she was. I'd momentarily forgotten that I was in Botswana and I thought I was in Edinburgh.
Well, you've talked about the way in which the sense of place is important in the writing of these, particularly those series of novels. Are those things that keep you grounded on the character as well?
Yes, I find that sense of place is tremendously important. I tend not to see my characters' faces. So I really don't know what any of them actually looks like. I've got a sort of fuzzy idea of their appearance. I know what sort of clothes they wear. Not that I necessarily describe the clothes. It's an interesting thing, actually. Male novelists never tell the reader what the characters are wearing, whereas female novelists do. It's quite a striking difference there. And so I tend not to describe the clothes, but I've got a sense of the presence of the person, but I've got a very strong sense of the place and where they are, and that's very vivid in my mind. And I think that you can, with a few strokes of the brush, convey a whole atmosphere, convey a whole moral atmosphere, convey a great deal just by describing some little feature of the place and then leaving the reader to fill in the details. So you might just describe, for example, the smell of rain in Africa just before a storm. There's that extraordinary smell, which is unlike any other smell. And you just hint at that. And then anybody who has ever experienced a storm in Africa or you get a similar smell in other dusty conditions will know exactly what. And then that will trigger a whole picture in their minds.
The HBO BBC pilot and series on the number one ladies detective agency obviously concretized the appearance of some of your characters. What's your relation to the film and television series?
I've been very, very pleased indeed with what HBO and the Weinstein Company and the BBC have done with that film, that wonderful film that Antonin Minghella made, which was, alas, to be his last film, but also with the series which has followed it. I think they've done a beautiful job of that, and the casting has been really, really good. I know that they were very worried about finding Mara Motsui, and indeed, more or less, up to a few weeks before they were due to start filming, they hadn't confirmed who Mara Motsui would be. And then they got this wonderful actress, Jill Scott, who's by way of being a well-known jazz and blues singer, and she's done a magnificent job. And so it was fine from my point of view because I didn't have a strong sense of what Armand Swy's face looked like. And so when Jill Scott turned up, I said, well, that's fine.
Well, it's certainly something that all of your readers are enjoying seeing in another form as well. Let me ask you a little bit about some of your favorite books. You obviously have won many literary prizes, and you play a role in the James Tate Black Memorial Prize. How do you approach the difficult task of judging literature?
Well, I suppose I don't do a great deal of that. I am asked from time to time to judge competitions, and I've been asked to be a judge in some fairly major literary contests, and I tend not to do a great deal of it because I find it very difficult.
Well, who are your favorite authors?
My favorite authors, I have got a number. The various contemporary authors whose work I watch with interest. I've recently been reading Louis de Bernier's Birds Without Wings, which I think is a wonderful book set in the Ottoman Empire. I think that that's a magnificent book. I think he's a very, very good writer indeed to produce that. I very much like the work of W. H. Auden, who's my greatest literary enthusiasm. I'm working on a book about Auden, my reaction to Auden's work. I think that Auden's work is something that you can carry with you through your entire life, quarrying different parts of it at different times and finding great comfort and consolation and interest in his work. I was very fond of an Indian writer called Narayan, R.K. Narayan, who wrote a series of novels set in a town in India, imaginary town called Malgudi, and his Malgudi novels, I think, were really superb. He wrote between the 1930s and the end of the 20th century. One of the first Indian writers to write in English for an outside audience. And, of course, we've seen so many wonderful novels follow from Indian writers since then. It's a whole beautiful area of literary endeavor. So I like his work and all sorts of other writers. I tend to read quite broadly.
Well, you also play music, although here you don't hesitate to judge it and to say it's really terrible. Although you've won so many literary awards, apparently there'll be no prizes for the really terrible orchestra. But I wonder if you could tell us about that endeavor.
Well, the Really Terrible Orchestra is an orchestra that my wife and I founded about 13 years ago for people who can't really play instruments but who would like to be in an orchestra. And we realized that our children were having such fun in school orchestras or had such fun in school orchestras that we could try and do a similar thing ourselves. So we set up this orchestra for musically challenged people, and we had lots of people join us, and we have great fun. We sound awful. Amateur orchestras usually sound a bit flat. We sound very flat. But we do several concerts a year, and we've now started to tour. Last year we played in London. We are based in Edinburgh, so that was quite a long trip. And we played at a concert in the Cadogan Hall, which we filled with people who'd come to hear something go wrong. And we didn't disappoint them. We really were very bad. And then we decided to go to New York. And we played on April the 1st, April Fool's Day, in the Town Hall in New York to a wonderful audience, 1,300 people, who came along and entered into the spirit of this in a very, very generous fashion. So the concert was a great success. And five offshoot orchestras have, over the last year or two, been founded in the United States. People have set up Really Terrible Orchestras in various places. There's the Really Terrible Orchestra of Philadelphia, for example. And this is just great fun. We enjoy it immensely.
I understand one of the devices is offering wine before the concerts. Is that couldn't have been done for the 1,300 in the audience at Town Hall?
No, we weren't able to do that in New York. But the audience, nonetheless, in spite not of having had a glass of wine beforehand, entered into the spirit magnificently because we had a number of audience participation events in that concert. We had Sing Along the Sound of Music, which the New Yorkers loved. They did look over their shoulders just to check to see whether everybody else was singing before they began to sing. But it went on very well.
Well, thank you. I think people will be glad to know that they can play music as well, even if they are really terrible and are held back, as you say, by lack of talent and lack of practice. But people will enjoy even more continuing to read your wonderful works of fiction. Well, we don't have a selection from the really terrible orchestra, but you have brought a third selection for us today. Could you tell us a little about that?
This third piece of music is the bagpipe part of a piece of music by the Scottish composer Peter Maxwell Davis, who lives in Orkney. And it's from Orkney Wedding with Sunrise. And it's an example of how the pipes can be used with other instruments. People tend to think of the pipes as just being played by themselves, but here they're used with other instruments. I love the pipes, and I love Scottish music. And this, I think, is a marvelous, stirring piece, very suitable for finishing anything, including a conversation.
Thank you. We've been delighted to be speaking today with Alexander McCall Smith about his writing and about his background. We thank you for appearing with us on Profiles.
Thank you very much indeed.
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.